This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Jedediah Purdy had a carefree childhood traipsing through the wilderness in West Virginia. He spent much of his time reading on the farm that his parents lived on as part of the Back to the Land movement of the 1970s. So no one was more surprised than Jed himself when just a few years later, his first book, For Common Things, threw him into the limelight, including a reference by superstar comedian Jerry Seinfeld on Saturday Night Live. The book pushed back against the cynicism and apathy in the late 90s and called for a more engaged and earnest public. Jed continued his own political engagement, first as a writer and a student, and now as a Duke law professor and activist. His most recent book, After Nature, examines the complexities of a political engagement in the Anthropocene era. Jed Purdy joins me now on the State of Things. Welcome back, Jed. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Frank. I'm really glad to be here with you.
Well, let's take you back to those days when you were traipsing the mountains of West Virginia. Talk about your childhood.
Sure. Well, it wasn't wilderness, for sure. It was a pretty wrecked landscape in a lot of ways. Topsoil was gone. I'd been depopulated twice, first with the arrival of European settlers. Then after the Second World War, small farmers left for the factories in North Carolina and Ohio. And my parents were sort of a third wave of settlement there. They and a bunch of other people who came from the cities and the universities around the East to find small farms and start farming there. And that's what they were doing when my sister and I grew up there.
This is an intentional community. These are people who bring themselves together based on principles, based on ideas. They didn't just find themselves in a zip code and kind of make it work, right?
No, that's right. They were very inspired by a writer called Wendell Berry, who'd written about the idea of taking place seriously, of resettling places in an unsettled society. My dad said to me once that they tried to find a small corner of the world and make it as sane as they could. He's not a guy who uses big phrases like that very often, so I think it was something he'd thought about a long time and meant it.
Could you tell if it was any part of their aspiration to sort of grow this idea to become a model, or was it to just get away from what they understood was maybe perhaps a toxic environment?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think they I don't think they knew. I think they'd sort of drawn the circle of what they were going to try to shape to the horizon of what they could see and people they could know in an area they could actually, move across in the course of a day. I think they'd kind of pulled themselves back from a time when people were thinking a lot about the direction of history, the sweep of big changes, and tried to focus on the level where they could actually see the patterns and kind of put their hands on them.
That's interesting. I mean, maybe the problem is trying to become a model that everybody can replicate that the whole way. I mean, that's kind of the problem. It's a form of megalomania, I guess.
You do get out in front of yourself when you try to ask that question, when you start asking about whether something scales before you know how it works.
What it is,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, what it is.
So did you realize that this was not normal, that this is not what most other families are doing?
Yeah. Yeah, I did. I did because there was kind of a cultural gap to bridge between families who'd been there a long time, traditional Appalachian folks, and newcomers like us. The term that they used for us was outsiders, which lets you know, keeps you aware. And definitely we were different from everyone else in our parents' families. We didn't go to school. We didn't wear shoes. We didn't go to the grocery store very often. For starters.
Well, I'm going to ask you, you didn't go to school until you were 13. So in those first 13 years, how would you you obviously had some kind of education. What was it? How would you describe it?
Yeah. People think of a lot of different images when they hear the term homeschooling. Mm-hmm. And maybe something people call unschooling is a better way to describe what they were after. They had the thought that kids are just curious. And if you give them their head and you give them some books and some space and answer the questions they have, they'll absorb a whole lot of stuff, at least early on. So there wasn't a whole lot of structure. Did a few things formally, like a little arithmetic, a little geography. I still know the state capitals, which feels like a really 19th century thing to know.
Can you do them alphabetically? Well, I'm not going to ask you that. Go ahead. So, did you read a lot? Did you do a lot of reading?
Man, I waited to be able to read like I waited for my driver's license because it was the thing that I wanted to be read to. And then when I could read to myself, I read for hours and hours and hours. Good stuff and bad stuff. It didn't matter.
What kinds of things did you find a preference? Fiction, nonfiction? What were you reading?
I read all the Hardy Boys. I read all Nancy Drew. I read all the Bobbsey Twins. I was not too discriminating.
Yeah.
I read all Tom Swift. Those are great, by the way.
The Tom Swifties and the Hardy Boys, man, the formula, me too. It's just a great, comfortable formula and sort of the way these books unfold. I mean, the first one isn't half as nice as the third one once you get where they're going.
Yeah. The funny thing is I don't really read genre fiction anymore. I had my fill.
You had your fill. I think you're done with it. So at 13, you did decide to go, and you decided to go to public school, right?
Yeah.
Did you make the announcement? How did your parents feel about it, and why did you decide this?
To their credit, they were really relaxed about it. I think they saw the decision as ours. My sister and I decided at the same time. We did it because the community that we'd grown up in was starting to disperse and fragment. People realized it was hard to make a living there. It was hard to make a living off the land. People freaked out about the schools and went back to the suburbs as the kids got older.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd grown up in a little pack of barefoot kids, and most of those kids were gone. And I think we also were just at a point where we weren't as excited about being on the farm all day. We wanted to be around other people our own age.
Well, before I get you into that classroom, I want to hear a little bit more about what you did when you weren't reading. Did you spend a lot of time outside asking questions about what you ran into?
Yeah. I loved to be in the woods. I loved then and I love now. I think I love now because I loved then to just explore the lie of the land. You know, just follow a ridge until you drop off it, and then you're in some valley, and then you climb another ridge and you're in a whole different terrain, and you sort of stitch together all those different maps of walking and finally get a sense of how it all fits together, which there takes some doing because it's a very irregular landscape. It's all formed by millions of years of erosion. And the valleys or the hollows and the ridges are really two different spatial patterns that don't really correspond to each other. So if you're up on a ridge and you drop off at, say, 15 degrees to the right of where you thought you were going to drop off, you might be in a completely different valley. And you can know how to walk the valleys and not know how to walk the ridges. So it's a place where you can get lost and you can find places to hide and you can also find a commanding view. And I loved that. I also I learned from old people who were from there some of the things that you could find in the woods. They took me ginseng hunting, mushroom hunting, and that really gave me a kind of taste for knowing the names of things and being able to sort of see them as you walk.
Well, I would think also it just improves your acuity as you start looking for little signs that you've been overlooking all this time. You just become more aware, I would guess.
The trick I kind of realized, and I didn't know it until I learned how to do it, is that you don't look for something in particular. You don't have kind of a hard gaze where you're looking for a specific pattern, like a certain leaf shape. You have to have kind of a soft gaze and be taking it all in at once without focusing on anything. And then you're kind of open to the little anomaly or the unexpected pattern. And that's kind of what that walking discipline is about.
So then what was it like for you at the age of 13 to sit down in a classroom and go to school? How was that transition for you?
It was a shock. It was kind of like learning a second language to find how to get by in that new situation. I mean, I learned since that middle school notoriously is a rough time. I didn't know that was generally true then, but I did know that it was true for me. I wasn't used to being inside and sitting still all day, and I also wasn't used to the kind of, the social world. That social world. That's a different kind of place than any that I'd been
before.
Well,
just imagine the hippie's kid who's been running barefoot over the hollers of West Virginia showing up in middle school for the first time in his life.
Yeah, and
that's pretty rough.
Who talks like a book. yeah. half the time.
Pretty rough stuff. But you went through it and then decided to go to Exeter.
Yeah. I got to a point where I kind of needed to move. I was intellectually, just in terms of learning, I was hungry all the time in public school, and I didn't even know I was hungry, but I knew I was discontented and that I had to do something else. And applied to, yeah, Exeter boarding school in New Hampshire and got a scholarship and spent my last year of high school there, which was sort of like learning a third language socially, because that was another totally different and strange place. But man, it was so exciting to be in a place where there was no limit on what you could learn and actually no limit to how excited people were willing to get about it with you.
Yeah, I mean, I would think the social structure there could be pretty difficult. On the other hand, there is intellectual rigor that you'll find in few other high schools.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, we'll talk more. Jed Purdy is my guest today. He's a professor at Duke Law. His latest book is called After Nature, and we are meeting him today on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. My guest this hour, Jedediah Purdy, an author of four books and a Duke Law professor. And we left you at Exeter High School, an all-boys high school, right?
Not anymore.
Not anymore?
Had been
okay.
for a long time.
Had been for a long time. But a pretty privileged place. You went there for your last year of high school. And then when you graduated, you didn't go right off to college, right?
Yeah, I went back to West Virginia, and I spent a year working in environmental politics full-time, which was a lot of community-level kind of organizing stuff, some work at the state legislature as well. It was a way of getting to know I didn't intend it this way. I just thought it seemed like the thing I wanted to do. But it turned out to be a way of getting to know where I'd grown up in a really different way than you do just being there and taking it for granted, sort of knowing what people are fighting about in different places, knowing how the kind of history of the state's economy is overlaid on how people are living there now.
When did you get this call for sort of for political action? I mean, clearly this is a job, and it's not the same as understanding the environment or writing about the environment. You're talking about engaging in real political activity.
That job came out of something that happened when I was 14 or 15. There was a proposal for a big garbage dump in the county next to ours. It was going to take East Coast garbage and sewage sludge. That was a big thing then. This was around the time of the famous garbage barge crisis, when that kind the wandering garbage barge off the coast. And I knew people of my parents' generation who were working to try to stop it from coming there, and went to meetings with them and went to public hearings with them, and it just seemed important, obviously, and I felt like these were people whose work made sense to me, and I wanted to know more about it. So I kind of made a plan in my mind that I was going to go to them sometime and work with them, and that's what I did.
Did that year off in any way focus your intention or your sense of your sense of direction?
It might have had the opposite effect, because it really locked in a permanent engagement with environmental stuff at a bunch of different levels that ran in parallel with other interests that were more about political philosophy and the history of ideas. So I was always sort of tacking back and forth between those two. And I think it also locked in a sense that it's really important to find ways to be engaged with real live present issues in the institutions in the place where you live, at the same time that I was kind of an abstract guy, and it was always attractive, important actually, for me to spend some time in my own head and with old books. So I'd say it only made the landscape more complicated and crowded, actually.
What did you, I mean, I think this is important, and we don't see enough of this in public life at all. Either one is engaged at some abstract level and can write, you know, long tomes about how things should be in structure, or perhaps you're engaged but can get lost in the trees. Did you find yourself having to flee, or did you find yourself always trying to bring them together?
I think it's always back and forth.
Yeah.
I think sometimes if there are two things that are really different from each other that you love, You will flee from one to the other sometimes, even if it's with relief. But definitely, the thinking and writing make sense to me most of all when they come back to the ground and when they come back to people's experience and what's really happening. And when I am doing something that's more on the ground, in some ways I haven't fully done it until I've thought it through to the point that I could write something down about it. You know, I might or might not, but that's kind of my way of metabolizing experience. It's almost at the metabolic level for me.
Well, we'll talk more about this. We'll get into some of the concrete examples of your writing and your activism, but I want to lay some more of the groundwork, too, for how you got there. You went to Harvard. Talk about that decision.
I almost didn't. I was going to go to Swarthmore Liberal Arts School in eastern Pennsylvania, and it was a hard choice, I think, because I really come from people who have an aversion to even a kind of suspicion and hostility toward concentrated power and concentrated privilege. At the same time, I'm obviously not totally averse to it because there I went. And on one level, there was just a kind of immense curiosity. This is the center of so much. It's like the Death Star of undergraduate education.
Yeah.
So I wanted to know what it would be like. I was fascinated, and I thought, you only go to college once. Still not a very clear answer, but I did.
Not for some of us, Jed, but go ahead.
All right. Fair enough. I know. I knew so little. It was an amazing place in some ways. I got a lot of thinking done, a lot of reading and writing done. I don't know how much of that is down to Harvard and how much of that is just being in a time and place in life where a lot of space is carved out to think and read and write. I loved that. But I think I would have loved college just about anywhere. I definitely went through there wanting to be independent of the place in a psychological, I would almost say in a spiritual way. That sounds pretentious, and it would be pretentious if I claimed I succeeded, but I would say I had a very, not quite antagonistic, but agonistic relationship, like a struggling relationship with it, because there was an image I had of how you could go there and just sort of embrace it and end up marinated in a kind of self pleased privilege that I was really actually kind of afraid.
So you were afraid of being seduced by the privilege and the emblem of it all.
And becoming someone that I really wouldn't like or think well of. So I'd say I put a lot of energy into trying to come at it at a kind of odd and idiosyncratic angle. And I felt like the way I could earn that kind of second order privilege, like the privilege of dissent within privilege, was by working hard enough to be good enough by the terms of the place that no one could say I didn't belong there. But at the same time, I would always say that I didn't belong to the place.
So you talked about the success of that project. How successful do you think you were?
Medium.
I think I'll leave it at that. You were what was the center of your attention, or was it a center? Were you interested in a lot of things, or had you begun to focus on particular topics?
I was reading a lot of political philosophy, a lot of the history of social and political thought. I read a lot of John Rawls. I read a lot of Marx. I ended up reading Michel de Montaigne, 16th century French essayist, and writing my undergraduate thesis on him. He's this kind of He invented the essay, basically, as a modern form. He wrote about imperialism in the Americas. He wrote about the wars of religion. He wrote about his kidney stones and his
that one I
body.
Read.
Yeah.
No, forgive me for interrupting, but this is interesting because I've actually never heard of him. This is the first I've heard of him, and it sounds like a fascinating character, which to me sometimes sort of speaks to the bankruptcy or near bankruptcy of our education and why we're not introduced to these thinkers and ideas somewhere along, you know, in the first 12 years. Had you known much about him before you started reading, or is this what you discovered?
No. I started reading him, and I realized that this was a guy who was writing about politics. I mean, he was deeply engaged in the fact that Europeans were killing each other over confessional disputes all around him. Literally, the place where he lived got stormed by both sides in the French Wars of Religion. He was writing about the fact that the Spanish were slaughtering people in the Americas and talking about saving their souls. But he was interested above all in trying to use the form of the essay to get inside everyday experience and link that up with the big political themes that he was writing about, to think about how people became self-righteous, how they became morally blind, how the kinds of destructive fanaticism that he was interested in could begin at a very personal level with a kind of inability to feel the other people around you, or inability to feel even the half of your own experience that wanted to sympathize with them but that you cut off. So it's that kind of link between big political questions, really the biggest of his time, and these very intimate meditations that I think drew me to him.
After you completed your undergrad, you went to work at American Prospect as a writing fellow. What were you writing about?
Yeah. Well, I wrote about irony then. That was the essay that kicked off the book for Common Things that came out a few years later. I wrote about mountaintop removal in West Virginia. It was one of the first pieces, I think, to appear on that topic. It was when that really destructive mining practice was just getting going.
So you were writing about that, but also irony. Talk more about that, because mountaintop removal, obviously a very specific environmental political issue. But you're starting to think deeply about and criticize a kind of culture of irony and ambivalence that was certainly characterized the 1990s.
Yeah. I was starting to put words to this personal style and cultural style that I saw around me, and I'm sure I saw it in myself too, that I guess I would say was a kind of stylish and lightly worn but very pervasive cynicism that preemptively knew better than to take anything seriously, especially words, actually, and especially public and political speech. There was a kind of sophistication, or false sophistication, I think, that was rooted in knowing not to take something seriously before you even heard it, waiting for the punchline before you heard the point. And I thought that it was basically a fearful and toxic pose, and that it got in the way of, I'll put it this way. I thought it was a way of protecting yourself from the danger that's always present when you say anything that's serious, when you lay anything on the line, that it'll fall apart or fail or be laughed away. And if you laughed it away first, then you were safe, but you were safe at the cost of not having done anything. That was how it seemed to me.
Safe from two things. One, the accusation that you're taking something seriously, or perhaps being labeled as somebody who's taking, you know, now we know how you feel, really, earnestly. Mm. And that's dangerous because I'm vulnerable now that I've revealed something.
Yeah, you're exposed.
And I guess the other thing would be safe from a growing sense of futility. Do you see it also? Do you see it as an expression of hopelessness? I can't do anything about this, so let me just laugh it off and show you I don't care, and therefore I can't be hurt by the ultimate pain that I can't do anything about it.
I think that's exactly right. I thought this was a symptom, partly, of a moment in politics where it seemed like nothing could move, nothing could change, and people acted like nothing was at stake. That was really how the 90s felt to me.
And you cited as an example none other than Jerry Seinfeld and his form of humor as an object lesson. Let's listen to perhaps what might be a sample of what you were thinking.
Parents like to drag kids to these historical sites on vacation. I remember going to Colonial Williamsburg, and you see these supposedly authentic blacksmith there. You know, he's got the three-cornered hat and the knickers and the Def Leppard T-shirt. My parents took me to the Amish country, which to a kid, you know, to see a bunch of people that have no cars, no TV, no phone, they go, so what? Neither do I. It's just a whole community that's been grounded. And that's the way they should punish the kids after they take them home. All right, son, get up to your room. That's it. I've had it. You are Amish, young man. For the rest of this weekend, did you hear me? Amish. Don't come down till you make some noodles and raise a barn.
Okay, so first, Jed, that's funny.
It's funny.
Okay. Yeah. But what's the larger point here?
Yeah. Well, a clip for a clip, maybe. I used Jerry Seinfeld as an example in the book. Not so much to try to take him down as because he was such a powerful symbol of what I was talking about, of what I called the ironic individual who practices a style of speech that avoids all appearance of naivete. He subtly indicates the inadequacy of the things he says, the gestures he makes, the acts he performs. By the inflection of his voice, the expression of his face, the motion of his body, he signals he's aware of all the ways he may be thought silly or jejune, and that he might even think so himself. If you are going to make fun of him, he's already made fun of himself. He's already gone by the time you get there. Yeah. It's funny, it's effective, it's charismatic. It was hard for me to express in the book. It's a young person's book in that way, I think most of all, in that it has difficulty really embodying mixed feelings. I didn't find a way of expressing that it is all of those things, but it was also a symptom of a way that the time was out of balance.
We should point out that you were 24 when that book was published. Well, they got back at you on Saturday Night Live, which I think is fascinating. It's a little bit complicated here because Jerry's actually playing a character who had written a very popular book at the time, and not you, but they gave that character your name. So here's how it goes.
I will tell you what is up and coming.
Yeah.
Our first guest and his new diet book.
Oh.
Please welcome Dr. Jedediah Purdy.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's you.
He looks slim.
It's him.
Like a lady.
It's like a woman.
Look at that little booty on you.
Yeah, it's like a woman.
Tell us about the book.
Well, it's called The Realm.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Ooh. Oh, The Realm.
The Realm.
Yeah, The Realm. Now, see, I don't know what that means.
No. It sounds English.
Well, it's like the zone, but some people feel trapped in the zone. So there's a little more room in the realm.
I will not testify to your booty, but I'm wondering what you thought when you heard that, or if you did, and kind of what would you make of that?
I had to laugh. it's so meta, it's not even about me.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you learn pretty fast to take that kind of thing in good humor. Similarly, there was a piece in McSweeney's, which is Dave Eggers' magazine, describing a lost weekend with Jedediah Purdy. It was loosely based on Hunter S. Thompson in Las Vegas. And it described just incredibly debauched behavior. I'm in the back of Steve Wynn's hot tub, and I'm holding up a water-soaked copy of my book and shouting, "I love the common things." How can you not laugh at that?
But you were 24. This was a deep book. It has, you know, caused us to think deeply about many of these serious issues. But as you look back at this book now, how do you review the book and where you were in that moment?
Absolutely. So I just told you about laughing at the satirical reception of the book, but it got, like anything, mixed reviews and some hostile reviews that made me realize in hindsight how close I was to the book. I took those to heart, and one time, about 5 months after it came out, one night I hacked a copy of the book to pieces with a hunting knife. It was a kind of rage that is not usually part of my experience. My housemate at the time found me doing it and said, "What's happening?" And I said, "It's full of lies. This book is full of lies. And I think when I look back on it now, it wasn't full of lies, but of course it was imperfect. Of course it hadn't succeeded in saying everything I would have wanted to say. And of course, no one who read it could take it in quite the way I'd intended, because a book is always an imperfect bridge between minds, even if I'd perfectly realized what I had intended. So I would say that rather than a lie, it's a disappointment. It's a disappointment because it's the record of a hope of trying to say something that that I thought was worth saying, because I thought other people would recognize the experience I was describing of feeling caught in this kind of self-aggrandizing but also self-diminishing, kind of self-undermining, ironic pose, and would understand the sense of wanting to get out of it and wanting to connect up with the possibility of speech and of politics that could move things, and that saying it was a way, writing it down was a way of trying to give that experience back to people. Yeah. That you would recognize your own rejected thoughts coming back to you. And I think it did that for a lot of people. So I have this vivid sense that it didn't, that it is the record of a disappointment. And I now think every piece of writing is that in some ways, but it's, yeah.
Well, clearly it did bring you to public attention. People did engage with the book and with you as a writer, and you remained engaged. And we'll talk about how you grew from that journey as I continue my conversation with Jed Purdy on The State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Duke Law Professor Jedediah Purdy is my guest today, the author of several books, including For Common Things and his latest, After Nature. So we talked about your experience writing the book at the age of 24 for Common Things that brought you to public attention at a very tender age, and your emotional reaction to some of the critique of the book. What did you do next?
Finished law school. I spent a couple of years working in Washington in the kind of world of public writers, people writing about politics. Decided that wasn't my world, and decided to start teaching. I was thinking of a few things. I was thinking of becoming an environmental lawyer. I'd done a little work, really just a summer, but a very formative summer during law school with the Natural Resources Defense Council in the New York office, which did a lot of environmental justice work. I had thought about trying to make my way as a writer. And the thing that got clearer and clearer was that in any life, I would be looking for chances to write and teach, and I would do those for free. I would pay to get to do those. And there was this job where that was part of the job description, which was teaching. And it was in law, so it was close in some ways to institutions and close to power, but not quite in the belly of it. And so I jumped and came to Duke and started teaching.
Let me ask you what led you to law school in the first place. Why did you think that would be your profession?
It was a close call even at the time. But I'd been around a lot of lawyers, activist lawyers, in the year I spent doing environmental work. And they were sort of my people. They were verbal and nerdy and very, very useful. I sort of started to recognize that any movement or community can use more good lawyers around. And then I thought hard about getting a PhD in philosophy, intellectual history. And again, in the same way that there was something in me that was averse to getting too cozy in college, too cozy with Harvard, there was something that was averse to getting too remote from everything else, too locked away in my own study or my own head. And that was part of what pulled me.
You turned down the chance to get your PhD at Cambridge, right?
Yeah, I very fortunately was offered a fellowship that a Harvard senior gets to spend a doctoral period at Cambridge, UK. And it just seemed at the time, and I can only report this, it seemed too cozy and too clear to go spend a few years doing that and then come to law school at Yale. And then I don't know what I was afraid of. I was afraid I would have become someone else at the end of that. Maybe if I had had more self-trust, then I would have gone ahead and done it. But your decisions do shape you.
You seem like the kind of person, or no, you are a person who is just only comfortable at the borders where there can be no comfort otherwise.
I think that's one of the more perceptive things that anyone has said about me this morning. No, I think
the day is short.
I think that's exactly right. Really, yeah. It took me a while to figure that out, but yeah. I think that's right. I feel at home on margins and at borderlines.
So, talk about now teaching. You decide to come to Duke. You know, what were your aspirations then? What were your hopes at that moment? Yeah.
Well, I wanted to become a good teacher, first of all, which is a whole lot of work, exhausting mm-hmm. work. I also I wanted to become a scholar who could link up the kinds of things that I had written about in public with more specialized work, I guess. And that's taken a bunch of different directions, writing about inequality and the role that the law plays in producing and reproducing inequality, writing about how we should understand environmental questions going forward, writing about constitutional conflicts. And of course, I was also figuring out how to live in a new place, the first place I'd lived as an adult in a way, a little baby adult.
Were you still thinking about political activism at the time, or did you think you'd sort of lock yourself into the academy?
I think there must not have been a lot of space in those first few years in my mind. I know that I was just going all the time. I was working all day, every day, even on weekends. And I don't think I did more than go do get out the vote work on election day in 2004, for example. So I think that was as far as I've ever gone from that kind of work.
But you attend Moral Monday rallies. You were arrested.
Things really swung back a few years ago and in a way that became pretty important for me. Even in 2008, like a lot of other people, I felt there was a kind of awakening of possibility with the Obama campaign. I felt at the time, though of course history has turned out more complicated, that that campaign was actually trying to do what I had hoped for and for Common Things, use bold, daring public speech to mobilize people and dare them to try to make a different world. And I think that is what the campaign did. I don't think that's what the governance did exactly, and that's its own conversation. But that really pulled me back in 2008. That was a very important experience of getting back out onto the front lines. And then, of course, things took a very different direction in the politics of the state. And when Moral Mondays started in 2013, I went to see what it was, and I found that it was doing in a really different way than a writer does part of what I had hoped that writing could do, which is to say to a bunch of people who were kind of isolated, or at least in little pockets, of both their dissent from what was happening in the state and their hope that something better could happen, and said, you're not alone. You're not alone in that, and let's all go to the same place and be there with all our voices and all our bodies. And there's a real difference between writing and a movement. It makes a big difference when everyone is there in the same space, speaking together. It was very impressive to me. And the second week that I went with the intent of committing civil disobedience and getting arrested. I think in the week between, I had sat down and done a back of the envelope calculation about the meaning of rejecting the Medicaid expansion, seen it came to between 1,000 and 1,500 avoidable deaths a year in North Carolina, and that was the trigger I needed to take me over that threshold.
So you become engaged. You decide to get arrested. I want to step back now and kind of look at it, at the big picture, because you talk about these political movements and political philosophy. You know, we look at the Great Depression of the 1930s. That should have been a galvanizing moment for all working people to understand how the system works. It is very clear for whom the system works and for whom it doesn't. It had been abundantly clear for decades. But now, the biggest proof, the biggest crash of many over those decades, and the world moves toward fascism and not toward a progressive understanding of how to improve this system to make it work for everybody. You talked about the politics of 2008 after the aftermath of yet another proof of who the system works for, who it works against, and instead of making it work for all of us, a backlash. What's happening there, Jed? What's going on there?
Well, a lot of things, of course, a lot of things. I'd put it this way. I'll take a step back to make this observation. A lot of people who would like to see a world that's more equitable and more secure and less fearsome and where there's less to be afraid of are totally convinced that they can't trust the government or a lot of their other citizens to bring it about. And that turns the hurt and disappointment in a more unproductive and toxic direction. And I think that they're not necessarily wrong, because the government has been in the hands of, too often in too many places, people who actually have contempt for it, very little ambition for what governing could do, what politics could do. And they produce governments that are contemptible and politics that are contemptible. So that's people's practical lesson in what's possible. So in that way, I think cynicism is self-reinforcing, not only on the level of attitudes, but because it actually does make the world of institutions that people have to deal with. And then there's a lot to build back. When you think about the progressive change that did come out of the New Deal period in the U.S., it had a lot to do with decades of, as you know, decades of work building up a labor movement, building up a movement of reformist policymakers and thinkers, and building the social base and also the kind of intellectual faith to do something progressive with the moment.
What is the, so you decided to get arrested. So we've got two, I think, parallel tracks going on. The realm of ideas, an intellectual underpinning for understanding why one would be engaged. And then there's the engagement. There's getting arrested. Why was that important for you?
I remember one way I thought about it. It was the same way that I think about doing get out the vote work, for example, or any other kind of small thing that people end up at some point deciding that they are too important to do. There's something in the world I move in professionally where people imagine that at some point you graduate to being the policy advisor, the person in Mitt Romney's quiet rooms. And I feel like it's a really important democratic instinct, and one that I try not to let go out in myself, that if you think something is important to do and you're capable of doing it, you shouldn't think that you're too good to do it. So that was a part of it. A part of it actually came out of working in the law and thinking about law, and that's that I think civil disobedience is a very powerful vocabulary that we have in our kind of civic lexicon for defying the law in the name of something that you think the law could be. It's a very high form of respect for the possibility of the community that you live in to deliberately trespass against it and quietly take the consequences. It's a way of saying to everyone, I hope we can take this seriously.
Which speaks to the truth of that book for one brief and painful moment in your life you called A Bundle of Lies or Lies. That is precisely keeping ourselves vulnerable, uncomfortable in the real mess of doing the work of democracy, which doesn't come out the way you want and exposes your desires and exposes you to potential failure. It's that commitment to failure, commitment to pain, that actually transforms the system. And any other critique you want to make about the people who are doing this to you, in effect, is null unless you make yourself open to this pain.
I couldn't agree more.
Are we doing the work? Talk about Moral Monday. It's been around for a while. It's still an engaging and perhaps growing movement. And yet, in the immediate term, we don't see a lot of change. Is it effective? Can it be effective?
Obviously, I only speak for myself in this. I've only been a peripheral sort of civilian in that movement, and it has leadership, has strong visionary leadership. I think the disappointment of the 2014 election was pretty crushing. There was a sense that what we were doing in those rallies was not just building and affirming a community of people who believed things could go differently, but also alerting the conscience of the broader state to the stakes of what was happening at the legislature. And that, we hoped, would translate into a different electoral outcome. And although the state is totally gerrymandered, it's also true that the share of Republican and Democratic votes, and the movement doesn't present itself as partisan, but in this climate it is objectively partisan. The share of votes between the parties didn't change much in the next round. So that was hard, very hard. And I think that now the people who are really at the heart of that movement are trying to think of what you do next. And they're realizing that you need to build two kinds of power, the power of social organization, community, and institutions. I think that they are continuing to send young organizers out into the counties. And I think that they're thinking about ideas, and they're thinking about how the way that Reverend Barber has perfected of putting religious redemption and constitutional redemption, religious community of love and political community of justice in the same kind of voice, that's something that needs to be shared and needs to become a broader vocabulary that doesn't just come from the stage but comes up from many different places.
And that takes time.
That takes time.
You don't see the results in two or 3 years.
That's lifetime.
So what are you thinking about, Jed? What's next for you? What are you working on?
I've really taken the luxury of the period, the lull after the book about nature, after nature appeared, to write a lot of small things and explore, literally write essays, test new thoughts and see what they're willing to be. So I think the piece of writing that I felt closest to this fall was an essay on Ta-Nehisi Coates and this Italian author, Elena Ferrante, who's written a beautiful series of novels about women growing up in post-war Naples. I was obsessed with those books. I was fixated on both authors and didn't understand why it was that I couldn't put them down, as it were, in my mind, and also couldn't find what it was about them that was bothering me. And I finally realized that in both of them, what fascinated me was a kind of refusal of the book to comfort the reader by making the reader feel home, at home, or known. They were both books about the difficulty of connecting with and knowing other people, and the meaning of that difficulty for gender, class, political community. And there were books whose deep premise in both cases was that it's impossible to see other people lucidly, that we always see through a mirror darkly, but that it's also intolerable not to try. And the books were both themselves exercises in trying.
Jed Purdy, it is always a pleasure, and there's always too little time. And we had a wonderful conversation about your book, After Nature. We didn't talk about it at all in this conversation, but I would recommend to our listeners looking into our archive for that conversation as well. Thank you so much.
Frank, thank you so much.
Jed Purdy is an author and a professor of law at Duke University, and you can find a link to Jed's writing on our website as well, and of course at stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.